case will be taken under advisement. We move to the third case this morning, Teague versus Mayo.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jess Kranek from Kirkland & Ellis, and I represent the appellant, John Teague. Mr. Teague is a 72-year-old prisoner who has been in jail for 44 years.
Counsel, what was his initial conviction for?
His initial underlying conviction about 44 years ago was a rape conviction, Your Honor.
Sorry?
It was a rape conviction, Your Honor. In the 44 years that Teague has been in jail, he has brought one civil lawsuit, this one, which arises from an ongoing dispute between Teague and two prison guards regarding Teague's medical restrictions, a dispute that culminated in an assault in July of 1999. Now, as you're aware from the briefs, Mr. Teague has an eighth-grade education, he can barely read or write, and he has major back problems that often render him unable to leave his cell. But our judicial system is designed to permit even plaintiffs with Teague's limitations a fair chance to develop their claims. Here, the district court's mismanagement of the case deprived Teague of that opportunity for three reasons. First, because the district court delayed 26 months before it even screened Teague's complaint and allowed the case to proceed.
What was the reason for that delay?
It's unclear from the record, Your Honor. Basically, Teague's case was filed in September of 2000, and nothing happened. The case sat idle.
Was it filed in Benton or East St. Louis?
It looks like it was filed with the district court in East St. Louis, Your Honor. It's unclear from the record as to what happened. I mean, maybe the complaint got lost. Maybe it was just at the back of the shuffle. But regardless, the district court didn't conduct its initial screening until December of 2002, and the defendants weren't even served until February of 2003.
I thought it was because trying to get them to pay a part of the filing fee or something. That was the reason for the delay here.
That's an argument raised by defendants, Your Honor, but there's a couple of problems with that argument. First, it's not supported by the law. The only case...
See, I don't think that really makes much difference here. The question is, what is the remedy if what you say occurred and it was a violation, that the judge shouldn't have dragged us out and delayed the case so long? What could the remedy be here?
The relief that we're requesting is that the judgment be reversed and that T be given a fair opportunity to pursue his Eighth Amendment claims in their entirety. Now, the reason that we're requesting that remedy is...
So there's no remedy on the excessive force claim?
There is a remedy on that claim, Your Honor.
What could that possibly be?
Well, let me take this back a little bit. Teague, because of the district court's delay, wasn't able to proceed even pro se on his case until 3 years after the events underlying this dispute. And because of the district court's failure to appoint counsel until nearly 4 years after the case was filed, given his incompetence, he was basically unable to do anything to pursue his claims until 5 years after the events underlying the dispute occurred. Now, during that time...
He has a trial on that issue, and he loses. So what is the remedy if he should have been... the case should have moved more briskly through the system? I tend to agree with you that it should have, but what could the remedy be? You can't have a new trial here, can you?
Yes, you can, Your Honor. The remedy that we're seeking is one that this court routinely grants when a court fails to properly appoint counsel. Now, the remedy in that case is that the judgment is rolled back and the plaintiff is given a fair opportunity to pursue his claims with the benefit of counsel.
But he had counsel.
He had counsel.
He had counsel late, but he had counsel for the summary judgment motions, as I understand it, and for trial?
Right.
So why would we be ordering a do-over if he had counsel through those critical phases of the litigation?
I understand your concern, Your Honor, and that's certainly an argument advanced by the defendants, that basically any prejudice to Mr. Teague was cured because he was eventually given counsel about 4 years later. Well, there's a couple of problems with that argument. First, the district court denied Teague counsel during discovery on his first three motions for appointment. And if you look at the court's decisions on those first three motions for appointment, the court basically said Teague's going to be responsible for developing his case, but we may appoint counsel for trial. Now, not only is that argument contrary to this court's decision in Pruitt v. Moat, which requires a court to determine whether an inmate is capable of litigating and developing his claims. But it's a major problem here, because when the district court finally did appoint counsel to represent Teague in May of 2004, the discovery period had closed. And the magistrate judge's order appointing counsel stated that the appointment was for limited purpose, for final pretrial and for trial. Now, the defendants argue that discovery was thereafter reopened and that counsel had an opportunity to take full-blown discovery on all of Teague's case. But the only record document that they rely on to support that argument, Record Document 65, is a magistrate judge order from 2 years later, April of 2006, wherein the magistrate judge says Teague is going to be given 2 months of discovery on his remaining claim. And the only remaining claim at that point was his excessive force claim. During the prior 2 years, while the parties were briefing dispositive motions, there's no order in the record whatsoever saying that discovery is reopened or, for example, setting deadlines on fact discovery or, you know, the close of depositions, nothing of that sort. So whatever discovery may or may not have been allowed, it's simply unclear from the record. And the second major problem there is that regardless of what the court may or may not have allowed, the defendant's summary judgment motion was filed immediately after counsel was appointed. And several months later, that motion was granted based entirely on testimony from Teague's unrepresented deposition. So at that point, half of this case and half of Teague's story is eliminated. That aspect of this case was never developed. And so at this point, it's very difficult to say that the result is reliable when you're dealing with claims that are so inextricably intertwined, that arise from a continuous series of events that progressed over time and gradually led to an assault, when, you know, basically what happened is a portion of those events was parsed out. Now, the perfect example is this court's decision in Cooper versus Casey, where guards assaulted a group of inmates and then deprived them of medical care after the assault. Now, both of those claims proceeded to trial, and this court held that in that situation where guards assault prison inmates, they actually have an obligation to ensure that those inmates receive proper medical treatment. So in that situation, the burden on the prisoner of establishing deliberate indifference is actually lower. Basically, what this appeal is about, Your Honors, is that when counsel was finally appointed, he was handed a case to lose. His hands were tied by the prior 4 years of the district court's mismanagement of the case. And with respect to his development of the excessive force claim, he was even hampered there. At Teague's deposition, counsel for defendants led Teague into agreeing that the motive for the assault was that the defendants were retaliating against Teague for a crime he had committed 27 years prior. Now, at trial, defense counsel repeatedly made Teague look like a fool for thinking that. You know, how could you possibly think that somebody who wasn't even aware of this crime would lie in wait for 27 years? And just to give a clear example, if you look at pages 34 and 35 of Volume 2 of the trial transcript, you'll see that defense counsel devoted 2 pages of his closing argument to making the point that Teague's theory on retaliation was entirely implausible. So given that, it's clear that the 4-year delay did have an impact on this case, and therefore that the result...
What evidence was he able to present with regard to the sodomization and those types of things?
There was evidence presented with respect to that, Your Honor, yes. But what I'm saying here is that it is reasonably likely that had Teague been given counsel at an appropriate stage, for example, when his motions for appointment were filed 4 months after his complaint was filed, you know, those motions didn't get docketed. They sat on the docket. They sat unaddressed until the court finally reviewed the complaint. But had Teague had counsel at that point and had the opportunity to take full-blown discovery on all of his case, certainly he wouldn't have lost summary judgment. He would have had the opportunity to develop evidence to support his deliberate indifference claim. He would have been represented at his deposition, and therefore he would not have lost summary judgment based on a couple of statements taken out of his deposition. And certainly he wouldn't have gone to trial at such a deficit here. Now, I'd like to just skip back to a couple things on the delay point that I haven't addressed. Here, when Teague's complaint came in, Section 1915A required the court to take a look at that complaint as soon as practicable after docketing. The review that we're talking about here requires an absolutely minimal effort. The district court is only required to look at the allegations on the face of the complaint, and if they're insufficient as a matter of law, eliminate the claims and allow the case to proceed. There's absolutely nothing impractical about a plaintiff expecting that a court can conduct that review sooner than 26 months. So in this case, not only was it an abuse of discretion for the court to wait so long, it was completely unreasonable. A lot of cases proceed to trial by the time it took Teague to even get up to bat. And the district court judge here even recognized that Teague's case had fallen through the cracks. On page 21 of volume 1 of the trial transcript, the district court judge commented on the record that he was not proud of the fact that it took 7 years for the case to get to trial, even on Teague's excessive force claim. Now, with respect to the appointment of counsel issue, we've been discussing the prejudice here. I'd like to back up and just discuss for a second the court's analysis on those motions that it considered. Under this court's decision in Pruitt versus Moat, the district court was required to consider, first, whether Teague had tried to obtain counsel, and second, whether, based on the record, he was competent to litigate his claims, basically whether he was competent to develop them. Now, the first element here is undisputed. But as to the competency issue, there's no question that the record showed that Teague was incompetent, and defendants don't even really argue to the contrary. For example, if you take a look at any page of Teague's deposition, you can see just how incompetent he really was. He began that deposition by stating that he needed an attorney because when it comes to the law, he was lost. Defense counsel nonetheless proceeded with the deposition, and in response to his questions, Teague consistently gave rambling, incoherent answers that often spanned 3 or 4 pages of the transcript. In fact, at one point in his deposition, he even asked defense counsel for help in establishing his case. So clearly, Teague did not understand what the entire process was about, and that's particularly problematic when further down the road, that deposition is used against him not only on summary judgment, but impairs what counsel is able to do at trial. Now, before I sit down here, I see I'm entering my rebuttal time. I'd just like to point out a couple of things on the deliberate indifference claim. There's no dispute here that the medical conditions that Teague was suffering from are sufficiently serious to support an Eighth Amendment claim, both his pre-existing back condition and the injuries that he alleges were inflicted by the assault. What is in dispute is whether the defendants were deliberately indifferent to those conditions. And the record before the district court, which was entirely minimal, demonstrated that the defendants, based on Teague's deposition testimony, demonstrated that the defendants interfered with Teague's prescribed treatment for his pre-existing medical condition by refusing to acknowledge his restrictions and then assaulting him because they were basically annoyed by those restrictions. And with respect to the injuries after the assault, well, it's undisputed that the defendants locked Teague in his cell, came back to his cell when Teague faked a suicide attempt, and then took him to the healthcare unit. And they weren't assigned into the segregation unit where Teague was later taken to. There's a couple things the district court overlooked. First, Teague testified that when they arrived at the healthcare unit, the defendants told the doctor on call that Teague had been in a fight with his cellmate, and that they were then responsible for Teague being sent to segregation based on the false charge that Teague had pushed one of them. In other words, his testimony was that he didn't receive proper treatment and he suffered in segregation for the next 4 hours because of misinformation supplied by the defendants. Now, I'd just like to emphasize that a document attached to the defendant's summary judgment motion, document 164 of our appendix, is a record from the healthcare unit reflecting that the defendants told the doctors on call that Teague had been in a fight with his cellmate, consistent with his deposition testimony. If he was taken there because of the suicide attempt, I ask you, why did the defendants need to explain his injuries? Thank you, Your Honors. So,
Mr. Burks.
Good morning. My name is Paul Burks, Assistant Attorney General, representing the defendants, Sergeant Mayo and Officer Taylor. I'd like to start out by talking a little bit more about the remedy that might be available, as Judge Evans suggested at the beginning. to the plaintiff for the wrongs he alleges here. And I think the best place to start on that is to talk exactly about what his counsel did do once his counsel was appointed. Judge Sykes mentioned that his counsel litigated the summary judgment motions and tried the case, but his counsel also did discovery. And I think opposing counsel may have misread the procedural record in the trial court, because the plaintiff or the defendant's motion for summary judgment was filed in October of 2004. In January of 2005, plaintiff's counsel deposed both of the defendants, and he didn't respond to summary judgment until March of 2005. So there was an entire period after the filing of summary judgment where the plaintiff's counsel had discovery available, was able to do it, and did do it, and did in fact depose both the defendants and conduct other discovery. What that other discovery might have been, we don't know, because none of it was submitted in summary judgment record. But what he did say at the outset of trial is that he tried to contact, and in fact did contact, some of the potential witnesses that Mr. Teague had identified, but they didn't want to cooperate. So you have counsel actually doing everything that would be done in a case had he been appointed from the beginning. Now, it might be true that there were things that could have been discovered earlier in the case had counsel been there. It might be the case that exists, that there's something out there that wasn't available 3 years later. But remanding now for a new trial with counsel, it doesn't resolve that problem. It's not a remedy for the alleged injury, because he already had the counsel who did everything that he could do, tried the case, and was unsuccessful.
Was the institutional medical record intact? Did counsel, once eventually appointed after the long delay, have access to that?
He did, just as his counsel on appeal has access to the medical record and has cited it in depth in their statement of facts.
So there was no deterioration of the documentary record based on the lapse of time?
Not that I'm aware of. And in their appellate brief, they suggest, well, a counsel could have hired a medical expert to review the medical records. Now, maybe counsel did consult a medical expert who reviewed the medical records and his opinion was unfavorable to the claim. Maybe counsel didn't do that. But counsel certainly had the opportunity to do that after he was appointed a couple of years into the case. So that certainly can't be prejudice. The fact that no medical expert testified for the plaintiff does not indicate that that he was prejudiced by the delay in appointing counsel.
Just sort of digressing somewhat, you indicated that you thought the delay was because of attempting to recover filing fees from the petition.
I think that is an inference that can be drawn from the record. I believe that that the Martin case that I cited in my brief at least allows for the possibility that there's some discretion with the trial court as to how they want to enforce the requirement that they be paid for adjudicating these cases. Certainly there's nothing stopping the trial court from immediately screening the complaint after receiving the initial fee, whatever it might be, $6, $4. But I think the Martin case suggests that the court has some interest in ensuring the payment of those fees and may require more of a payment along the way. On that point, I would like to say that the delay in screening the complaint is not to anybody's advantage. For my clients to have to defend against a case that's 3 years old before they're ever served with the complaint is certainly not a benefit to us. And to the extent that there's any supervisory authority available to the court, since this is not an error that we knew about, that we could have even known about, were it an error, it would, I think, be helpful to all litigants if this were not a practice that were pervasive. And I really don't know how pervasive it is, or if this is
just... I don't remember seeing one
like
this before.
So, as to the... What that leaves us with, given that the delay problem really... We really haven't identified any prejudice from it, and we really don't have a remedy for it at this stage in the proceeding. That leaves us with the question of the summary judgment. I think that it would be helpful to the court to actually look at the summary judgment briefings if you have the opportunity, because the claim at summary judgment involved the incident on July 16, 1999, when the plaintiff alleges he was attacked. It did not involve a supposed... refusals to acknowledge medical restrictions along the way. He claims he was injured on that date, and then he was left in segregation suffering from these wounds. Now, as to that particular claim, on appeal they have plaintiff has argued on appeal that what the district court held was that claim fails because there's no evidence that defendants were in charge of plaintiff when he was in segregation. They weren't there, so they couldn't be liable for leaving him there to suffer. And what the plaintiff has argued on appeal is, well, what they did is they misrepresented to the doctor that he had been in a fight with his cellmate, and that misled the doctors into not treating his wounds. And they point to a document in the record here in oral argument that shows that, in fact, the defendants did tell the medical personnel that he had been in a fight with his cellmate. But if I might point to a document in the record as well, which would be Exhibit 3 to the plaintiff's response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, and that is a contemporaneous grievance filed by the plaintiff on the date of the alleged assault, in which he grieves that he was attacked by these two guards. He doesn't say anything about a sexual assault, which is what actually went to trial, but on the date of the actual alleged assault, he doesn't say he was sexually assaulted, and he says, I would also like to say that I got in a fight with my cellmate. I was abused by my cellmate. So there's no evidence in the record that anything was misrepresented. And I think when you get to the end verdict by the jury where they find that no such assault occurred, and you have to accept that on appeal, given that it was a fair trial and he was counseled throughout all the relevant portions of the case, and you have to accept that no assault happened, the medical indifference claim, it has to disappear from there because there can be no indifference to injuries that were never occurred, injuries from an assault that never occurred. And so the medical indifference case sort of fades away at that point. The last thing I would actually like to mention is the question of forfeiture, whether the magistrate's rulings denying plaintiff's motions for appointment of counsel, which were not appealed by the pro se plaintiff, was forfeited. Certainly on the face of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, they were forfeited, and the plaintiff has not argued otherwise. He's instead in his reply brief suggested he's entitled to an equitable exception to the forfeiture doctrine because of his alleged incompetence in litigating his case. We have pointed to a Second Circuit case that rejects that. The Second Circuit case, Kaidor, says that if a rule is right there in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and all somebody has to do is read the rules, then they will be held to it whether they're counseled or not. That seems to be a principled approach to when an equitable exception to this court's procedural rules will apply. I think the way the Second Circuit put it is this is not a plaintiff who was caught in the snare found only in our case law. This is something that's right in the rules. And Rule 72A says any non-dispositive interlocutory order by a magistrate judge that is not objected to in the district court is forfeited on appeal. So to the extent that there is a viable claim under Pruitt and potentially prejudice and a remedy, that which we've already talked about, that claim was in fact forfeited below.
I'd like to go back to the summary judgment on the deliberate indifference claim. And as I read it, certainly as it's being argued now, it does have two aspects to it, deliberate indifference to the attack-related injuries, and then deliberate indifference to the medical orders that were operative with regard to this inmate because of his chronic condition. And I think both were briefed, albeit less completely in the district court than here on summary judgment, but the district court sort of lumped them together.
Well,
Is that a fair characterization of what went on?
I think I would characterize it a little bit differently, which is to say that the claim was for the assault and the post-assault indifference, and that's what the amended complaint says. And then in the briefing they said, look at the evidentiary richness of our post-assault deliberate indifference claim because Sergeant Mayo, he never wanted to acknowledge those orders from the medical personnel. And so you can believe that when it culminated in this assault, it really happened and we should be able to go to trial.
But so it was argued as a as corroborating evidence and not as an independent basis for the claim?
That is correct. And I would say that to support that, I would point out that where's the evidence that they refused to acknowledge or that they violated the medical orders? There's his testimony that Sergeant Mayo was giving me static or Sergeant Mayo refused to acknowledge that order. But that stuff is very vague. And I think if the claim was actually being litigated, we would have presented evidence on what it was that Sergeant Mayo did in the course of quote-unquote giving me static. Did he say, hey, wait over there until I'm done with the chow line and then you can go? Is that giving me static? We don't know what it was that is the factual basis for the alleged refusal to comply with the medical orders, because it wasn't the case. The case was I was assaulted and then I was left to suffer. That was the case. And so we don't really have the evidence in the record, because it just wasn't developed, because it wasn't there. It wasn't in the complaint, and it wasn't developed through discovery. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Yes, sir. It has nothing to do with the case, but when is Illinois going to let this guy out? He's been in prison 44 years, and he's in bad health, and he's older than John McCain.
I don't know. I have no idea, but I'd be happy to inquire.
I'm just curious. What was the sentence here?
The sentence was...
We don't get many cases where people are in, life without parole or something.
I think it was this 1972. Apparently, while he was in prison, he was convicted of rape, and that rape was of a warden's daughter, from what I can gather of the record, and I think that sort of doubled up on his sentence a little bit.
I mean, his original conviction in 64. He's been in prison since 64.
Right, his original conviction in 64. I'm not sure what that was. I was under the impression it was murder, but I haven't checked it recently. Maybe it was rape. But then in 72, he was out on a work detail. I'm past my time, but he was out on a work detail, and apparently there was a rape occurred, and he was identified. And so he was convicted of a rape while he was in prison. So I think that might have added on. And actually, as long as we talked about the rape, opposing counsel mentioned that the cross-examination discussed the rape, and there was a lot in the briefing about plaintiff's deposition. And again, I would refer the court to the record if they do have the time, and it shows that the assistant attorney general who deposed Mr. Teague did not engage in any trickery or any false representations or any lawyerly gimmicks. He asked Mr. Teague to tell his story, and Mr. Teague told his story. And Mr. Teague told what he believed, and he believed he was being retaliated against because of the rape. And at trial, it was perfectly appropriate to point out that motivation...
Well, that makes some more sense, because if it was the warden's daughter, you're probably well known within the prison system that happened.
That is probably true. That's probably true. And that's why Mr. Teague believed. And this, a lot of this is sort of post hoc, reconfiguring of the record. But Mr. Teague believed that's why he was attacked and so that's why he was cross-examined on that point, and that's why he testified to it in his deposition. Thank you.
You have 1 minute.
Thank you. Just a couple of points, Your Honor. First, with respect to the argument that the deliberate indifference claims were not fully raised below, as you noted, Your Honor, there was a briefing on those issues below, and I'd like to point out that in their reply brief on summary judgment, the defendants specifically conceded that Teague's claim encompassed whether the defendants were deliberately indifferent to his pre-existing back condition. So contrary to their argument made now, the defendants were well aware that that was part of this claim below. Second, with respect to the alleged record and the opportunity to develop that record before the district court on summary judgment, it is clear that, defense counsel was able to take defendant's depositions. That's all we know from the record, because there's nothing else set forth in the record as to what counsel was or was not permitted to do. The medical records that counsel referred to was a small sheaf of assorted disciplinary records and medical records that was attached with defendant's summary judgment motion. But regardless of what discovery may have been in the record, counsel was defending multiple dispositive motions, and ultimately what the decision came down to was Teague's unrepresented deposition testimony, which resulted in the elimination of half of his case. Thank you for your time, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
You have the appreciation of the court for taking the appointment and representing your client quite well. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. Case number 4.